Session number 10314.
Spryly, reel 3. Do the kangaroo courts concern Germans or collaborators?
Well, also with their own people whom they deem to have been collaborators. You know, girls who'd been struck up relationships with German soldiers, were pretended to have their heads shaved and to be almost put in the stocks, that type of thing. And there were cases of summary executions, undoubtedly.
Was that of collaborators or
collaborators? Germans? No, collaborators in the main. Very difficult to know where the lines are drawn between collaboration and downright settling of old scores when times are very liquid and fluid in that direction. I wouldn't like it to be felt that, you know, this was a wholesale massacre of innocents or anything like that. But there was a certain amount of settling of old scores amongst people.
Did you see any executions?
I did, yes. Yes, they were usually fairly sharp and summary, pistol at the side of the head.
And this was conducted by the communist resistance, was it?
Yes, yes. I mean, when you're in that situation, if you've got anybody, also, if you've got a sense of anybody who's a traitor in your midst, there isn't a lot of time for the niceties of life. You do tend to take some, if you're reasonably satisfied, you tend to take some rather immediate action. I think you've got to remember also that our job was not to command people. These resistance groups had their own leaders, and the last thing one wanted to do was to usurp that leadership. We were there to advise and to assist and to help and to guide, but not to take over the job of actually leading the resistance group. And I had to be very careful not to intervene in domestic issues. And indeed, I think we were quite good at keeping out of the political issues. Now, that took us up to, well, I suppose, the Battle of Belfort, if I remember rightly, really developed. That was where the Germans turned to stand. Which, as I say, Belfort is just by the Black Forest there. Corner of Switzerland, France and Germany, where the three come together. And the Battle of Belfort really developed, I suppose, in November, December. And there, really, French resistance had done its job. There were odd pockets of resistance to be cleared up, there were parcels of prisoners to be dealt with and that sort of thing. But in the main, the role of resistance had finished because the enemy had gone. He was now back within his own homeland. Indeed, most of the people that had been, I mentioned 3,000 people in the resistance groups around the Byzantine area, many of them were absorbed into the French army itself, into the Free French Army under General Leclerc, and continued to serve in that capacity once their role as guerrilla fighters, as resistance fighters, had ended. And indeed, I was encouraged at one time to go with them and to become a member of General Leclerc's staff, but I'm glad I didn't in the end. So that really was the end of the French story. Our mission, as I say, finished when the Belfort Gap battle really started to build up. I came back to Paris, and I stayed at the British Embassy for 2 or 3 weeks in Paris. keeping out again a communications circuit, and then came back to the UK in late December of 44.
Where I think it was put to you to continue in your service.
Well, we were then, we had a bit of leave, and then we were, we all went, we, those who, many of us who'd been to France got, came back, came together again at Milton Hall. And clearly, there was a situation now where one was given the opportunity of either returning to one's own unit and being, becoming a regular soldier again, an ordinary soldier in Europe, or we were actively encouraged to go out to the Far East to become members of what was known as Force 136 in the Far East. But Force 136 was, of course, essentially a British operation. Previously we'd been a three-nation operation, an Allied operation. Obviously the Americans were not going to come to Burma with us and help us fight in Burma, nor were the French. And so we said goodbye to our old friends, and the Americans went off to, many of them went to China with OSS, Operation of Organization of Strategic Services, which was their equivalent of SOE, of course. The French went off to French Indochina, and many of the British went off to Burma and Malaya and that Far Eastern area of activities. So I opted to go to Burma, which meant going out to Ceylon in the first place for some familiarisation training. And that we went to Ceylon in January 45. But that didn't last very long because things were starting to move in Burma quite quickly. And the concept was going to be of a similar nature. We would be parachuted into Burma. And we would go in teams, again, of small numbers, not necessarily three, usually rather larger little group, perhaps six or seven, and there would be obviously a radio operator, there would be a British officer commanding the little group, there would probably be two or even three British officers, and there would be two or three Burmans, or if you were into Malaya, Malays, who had come out from Burma and had some training for this type of work. But the concept, again, of going in quite in a staff capacity for a small resistance group remained the same. That was the same concept. So far as teams were concerned, again, it was a matter of getting alongside people that one was happy and comfortable to be working with. Now I lost my two colleagues. I'd left them wounded in Europe, so I had to start again. And I joined up with a chap called Britton, Major Dave Britton, and another British officer called Jock Waller, Captain Waller. And we had two or three excellent Burmans who were really very good value. The two who were dropped into Burma with us, one was called Maung Than and the other was called Aung Tun. And after the after the initial familiarisation training in Ceylon, which consisted of learning to live in the jungle and learning not to be frightened of creepy crawlers and things that go bump in the night, We went to Calcutta, and the Air Force base from which one went into Burma was just north of Calcutta, a place called Jessore. And on the towards the end of March, third week in March, 45, we set off to fly to Burma. It was quite a long flight from Calcutta to across the Arakan, and we were going into an area which was about 150 miles north of Rangoon. So it was quite a longish flight, something like 7 or 8 hours. And they used Liberators for these particular actions. Now we went, the first flight we had was we could not identify the dropping zone lights. Finding four little bonfires in a big area is not an easy task, and we just couldn't find the fires at all on the first flight. And when we came back across, the pilot just couldn't do it, and so we came back flying fairly low over the Arakan, and one of the engines packed up. We never did know whether it packed up because it either, you know, just broke down, or whether we'd seen some Japanese attack fire. I don't think it actually hit, but nevertheless, one of the engines did pack up, and we landed at Cox's Bazaar, which is an airstrip on the west coast of Burma on the Arakan. And then we came back to Jessore, where we started off from another aircraft the following day. So it was about another week later, we had another crack at it. And we were late over the DZ. We were over an hour late from our anticipated dropping zone time. Again, we couldn't find the lights. I think everybody had packed up and gone home. So we did just that, and we came back again. If you're going on an operation of this nature, you do get keyed up to a certain extent. And to have made two abortive trips of that sort of distance was beginning to get on everybody's nerves a little bit. So the following night, we went again, and we went on the basis that we were going to be dropped whether we found lights or not this time. that nature. But we did find the lights, and we dropped in to a British officer who was already there, a chap called Major Carew. And we had an uneventful journey. We found a perfect layout of fires, and we all landed quite satisfactorily, with the exception of one of our Burmans. He suffered a very badly twisted ankle, and we had to leave him in the hands of this Major Carew, to whom we dropped. And so we were one Burman night from the word go. We were on the eastern banks of the Sitang. Burma is a country which is divided by three major rivers: the Irrawaddy, the Sitang, and the Salween. And they run virtually north to south, and there's very little lateral communication in Burma. And the Sitang is the river at whose southernmost point is Rangoon. And one anticipated eventually, if the pressure from the 14th Army was going to come from the north, as one was expecting, then eventually they would have to withdraw up the Sitang Valley from Rangoon and then move east across the road to a place called Mochi and on to Indochina. I mean, that was the way back, eventually back to China, back to Japan. And so it turned out. But we were on the wrong side of the Sitang for the job of work we wanted to do. And so we went to, we had a fairly long march, and the only transport we could get, obviously, in this type of terrain, mainly dense jungle with odd little cart tracks and one thing, until you come down right into the river valleys. So we journeyed by bullock cart and the like, carrying our such equipment as we had, which was a couple of radio sets for me, and the like, such arms and equipment as we'd taken with us. Then we had to cross the river itself, which was a bit hairy, because there was a fair amount of Japanese patrolling in the river. And one's first experience of a riverboat in Burma is very much just a hollowed out log of a tree and not much help. But we managed to cross the river satisfactorily. And we came back to, came north then to a little village called Chwebwe, K-Y-W-E-B-W-E. And we made that our base for the future. Chwebwe was, a small village on the edge of the jungle, about 150 miles north of Rangoon, about 30 miles south of Tongu, and we knew it was an area where there was loyal local support from the Burmans, who had had quite enough of the Japanese by that time, and who were willing to cooperate and work with us.
So you didn't come across any anti-British feeling from the Burmans?
Well, not at that stage. By that time, there was a certain amount of anti-British feeling, of course, and there was the Burmese National Army, which was raised really to fight the British. But the average Burman had had enough of the Jap by that time, and the average Burman who'd been in the Burmese civil service, shall we say, helped run the railways and helped run the local administration and that sort of thing, had come to realise very quickly on which side his bread was buttered. They were interested in long-term freedom. They wanted their own freedom in the long term. But they could see quite clearly they were far more likely to get it by cooperating with the British and getting the British back in the saddle than they would ever get with the Japanese. So you can say they were choosing the lesser of two evils, if you like. But we found we had a group of 250 men based on Chwebwe, loyal as they come. And we had a tremendous intelligence network in the Sitang Valley, which really, by the time we'd been there for 3 or 4 weeks, every time a Japanese soldier went to the toilet, we knew. It really was quite incredible, the information, source of information that we received. And we had a very successful, this operation was called Reindeer, was a code name. And it really was a most successful operation. And bear in mind, at this time, that the battle for Mandalay would be 350 miles to the north. And the battle for Mandalay was just beginning to develop. The 19th Indian Army Division fought for Mandalay and recaptured Mandalay. So there was a lot of Japanese activity starting to move. There was a rail, the Sitang, there's the river, there's a railway, and there's a road. And we were so successful in our setting of ambushes and the like, that we forced the Jap in the Sitang Valley to move entirely at night. And we did this in two ways. Not only were we able to organise our own people to set up ambushes and one thing or another, but we were also able, after we got, after the RAF had established themselves in the Mandalay area, we were able to have literally cab ranks of RAF fighter planes, and we were able to call on them and identify targets to them and direct them onto the targets. Like, I suppose the nearest thing you can describe would be a forward spotter for an artillery unit. And the RAF, of course, this was fantastic as far as they were concerned. Not only could we tell them where the target was, but afterwards we tell them afterwards exactly what they'd done and whether they hit it, whether they missed it, or one thing. Tremendous cooperation with me from the Air Force. And we had we played a very significant role in the Sitang Valley in making life very unpleasant for the Japanese. So much so that within a relatively short time, by the end of May, the Jap would not move in the Sitang Valley by daylight. And then Mandalay fell, and the 19th Indian Div came storming down the Sitang Valley. And then, let me get some idea of day. Towards the end of June, we had something of a setback in that we were involved in quite a severe firefight with a fairly small group of Japanese in the bend of the river. I wasn't with the party. I was dealing with my radio work, and Major Britton had gone off with this particular party, and sadly, he was killed in the fighting that took place. This was a pretty severe blow because he'd built up a tremendous relationship with the local people in and around Chuevwe, and they all thought him absolutely a great guy. I was obviously going to miss him terribly, and the other British officer, Captain Waller, had gone off with 50 or 60 of the chaps to set up another little camp about 40 or 50 miles away. But obviously we buried Dave Britton, and I carried on with the running of the show for the next few weeks. But fortunately, another Jedburgh team that had been to the north of us, north of Tongu, under the command of Major Rubinstein, known as Team Chimp, had been overrun by army, and really their role had ceased to be very effective. And so Dick Rubinstein came down and joined forces with me, and we worked together then for the rest of the campaign in Burma. And by this time, the army had arrived, the 17th Indian Div and 19th Indian Div had come down the valley. They'd taken Tongu, and really the Jap had now ceased to exist in recognisable unit form, so far as troops coming out of Rangoon were concerned. But what was now happening was that the Japanese divisions that had been fighting in the Arakan were now filtering through the jungle from the Arakan, coming down into the Sitang Valley, and then working their way back to Tongu and then across to Morchi. And so from fighting from all the guerrilla activity that we had in the Sitang Valley, we suddenly had to turn our attention to trying to identify these Japanese units that were coming across from the Arakan. And army were, of course, particularly interested in this because they were going to cut across their lines of communication as well. So from that point on, we tended to cooperate very closely with the 17th Indian Div, and we acted as their scouts and their guides so far as the jungle operations were concerned, for a distance of up to 100 miles into the jungle. And for this purpose we used a large number of Karens and various hill tribes of all sorts of nature. And again, they'd had enough of the Jap, they wanted rid of the Jap, and provided they were rewarded by us for information and indeed for action on their part, they were only too ready to cooperate.
You had money to give them.
Oh yes, we had money. More importantly, we had the thing that was desperately short in Burma at this stage was clothing, and a gift of clothing. The Burmese national dress consists of a longji, L-O-N-G-Y-E, which is really just a tube of cloth, which you like a skirt, and you pull it up, pull it over your legs, and knot it round your waist, and it is just like a long lady's skirt. And so we used to have bales of these longis dropped to us by Dakota, and we used to distribute them. And food was also important because we all